From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, immigrants and their supporters march in downtown Grand Rapids.
Frankly, the announcement last year to end DACA has created just a great deal of uncertainty in our community.
3 years of balanced budgets means Detroit is free of state oversight.
They now have the keys back to the car.
Saving a piece of history, the Detroit house where a future president and Civil War hero once lived.
And he lived in this house in question from April of 1849 to May of 1850. So it's a pretty short window, but we'll take it and call him an honorary Detroiter nonetheless.
Thoughts on being a black gun owner?
We are absolutely fearful just like anyone else. We worry about our lives just like anyone else.
And how to stop the brain drain of Michigan college graduates. Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Listen, my people, my condor, my eagle. No human being should ever be illegal.
Today, more than 1,000 people are marching through the streets of downtown Grand Rapids in support of immigrants and protesting deportations. Immigrants play a crucial role in the Grand Rapids economy, so says our next guest. Andy Johnston is the VP of Government and Corporate Affairs for the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce. Andy, I know the chamber isn't taking a position on today's march specifically, but what is the chamber's position on immigration reform more broadly?
Well, we know that immigrants play a critically important role in our community and the economy. Immigrants strengthen the quality of the talent pipeline, contribute to the local tax base, and create new businesses. And at the Chamber, we're advocates for long-term immigration reform, particularly DACA. So, you know, that's one of the key things that is bringing together these protests. And, you know, we have alignment with them on that because, frankly, the announcement last year to end DACA has created just a great deal of uncertainty in our community.
What do you think these marchers are saying and to whom as they gather today?
Well, I think, you know, number one, they're saying that immigrants have this integral role in the fabric of our society, our economy, and our community. And I think they're asking for, you know, long-term immigration reform. You know, they're looking to demonstrate that through these actions today and, you know, and leading up to today.
Take us more deeply, if you will, and help us understand just what immigrants mean to businesses and to the economy in the Grand Rapids area?
Yeah, you know, looking at some of the impacts that immigrants have, you know, on our state, immigrants comprise 8.3% of the state's entrepreneurs, and immigrants are almost twice as likely to start a new business. In Michigan, immigrant-led households earned $20 billion in income and paid over $5.4 billion in taxes. And then when you think of, frankly, the history of our communities, immigration and immigrants have played foundational roles in creating the West Michigan that we know today.
How is the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce involved in supporting immigrants in your city?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing, particularly around, I mentioned, you know, the uncertainty around DACA. You know, what we heard, you know, from our, particularly our Hispanic-owned businesses is that it was creating just a great deal of uncertainty because individuals had enrolled in the program in good faith, became ingrained in the community, and the decision to reverse course is impacting all sorts of businesses across our region. So, you know, what we did is we went and took those voices from our member businesses directly to our elected officials, and we facilitated meetings with our congressional delegation because those stories are so impactful so that they can carry those back to Washington. And then through our regional and national organizations have continued to push for immigration reform that makes sense for our community.
I'm interested. You talked about the uncertainty regarding DACA. What has been the on-the-ground effect of all this DACA uncertainty on businesses?
You know, I've been in a number of meetings with legislators. I frankly haven't been as moved, I think, as I've ever been when some of our members met with Congressman Huizenga. We had a young woman, entrepreneur. You know, entrepreneurs risk everything, put it all on the line to start their businesses. And this was a DACA recipient that had started her business. And, the uncertainty about ending DACA and saying that she has to go back to a country that she doesn't know, it moved us to tears, frankly, in the meeting. And it's those kind of stories that we continue to hear from our members that we're trying to, you know, convey to our elected officials.
Andy, have you heard any concerns from your members about how this one-day strike by immigrant workers might affect them economically? Is it much of a concern?
Yeah. You know, we've definitely heard from member businesses, particularly those that are, you know, receiving calls to close. That can be very difficult for small businesses and restaurants where there's particularly maybe small margins. You know, closing for a day, you know, can really have an impact. So there has been some concern from members. And so that's been something that we've been having to deal with.
The organizers say they want to support the Bridge of Justice and Resistance. Is Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce with them in that supporting that Bridge of Justice and Resistance?
I don't know enough about the bridge of that bridge that they're referencing, but I think when it comes to being advocates for comprehensive immigration reform, I think we're allies.
Andy Johnston, VP of Government and Corporate Affairs for the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce, where today thousands of people are marching through the streets of downtown Grand Rapids to support immigrants. Andy, thanks for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Detroit is back in control of its finances. It is out of oversight. It's a big moment for a city that just 3 years ago exited the biggest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley is with us now. Rochelle, when we hear that Detroit is out of oversight, explain what that means. What's ending? What's resuming?
Well, for people who watch the largest municipal bankruptcy in the nation's history, I think they sort of thought, oh, okay, well, they went into bankruptcy. Things are fine. Things have been working fine, but things are now at a point where people believe that they're going to be fine. And the Financial Review Commission, which unbeknownst to a lot of people has had to approve budget and spending for the past 3 years, no longer will have to do that. Now, the city will have to still file some reports with them on a regular basis to make sure that the budget continues to be balanced. But this means that Detroit is in charge of governing itself without state control.
And Detroit had to serve up three straight balanced budgets to make this happen. How significant is this?
Well, for a city where people questioned the ability to do that and thought that it wasn't possible because of low tax revenue and because of the way things worked and because of pension obligations, all types of things got in the way, and they were literally, you know, spending money that they shouldn't to try and pay the bills. This shows that this city can operate like a city, that it can spend within its means, and that it can do it consistently. They had to do it for 3 years, so it wouldn't be 1 year and it's a fluke or 2 years and it's luck. But 3 years shows that this is how it works now. So the great thing for me is that this, while it's big news, it's not a surprise. And that's the wonderful thing. Because of how hard people have been working across the region, you know, to make sure that Detroit thrives, and it still has some struggles and some things that it has to work on, but this was something that was coming. This is something that we watched coming, and it's here now, and it's like, yeah, this is exactly what was supposed to happen.
And who gets credit for this?
You know, there are people who want to detract from what Mike Duggan has done, and he has his critics, but this has been about a very solid bit of leadership from someone who said, this is going to work no matter what. He took expertise from the DMC. He took the political capital that he had from, you know, various other jobs, and he brought all of that to the table and said, we're going to run the city on what it can afford. And he did that. For the first time in years, you didn't have these major battles between the mayor and the city council. They worked together to make sure this worked. And quite frankly, the city is operating like a city. So a lot of that falls into his lap. Some falls into the city council's lap, because when you have two entities that are working together, that means both sides are doing it. And this council worked with this mayor in a way that council in the past has not worked with mayors to make sure that they got to this point.
So what does Detroit being out of oversight, what about the people in the neighborhoods in Detroit, the ones who've kind of been left standing in the shadows with the attention on downtown and Corktown and Midtown and District Detroit? What's in this for them?
Well, I think that part of the problem has been in the past that every time people in the neighborhoods, and you know, Midtown and downtown have neighborhoods too, but we're talking those folks out in the neighborhoods where there are homes, where there were property tax payers and income tax payers who kept the city going, you know, sort of kept Detroit up when Detroit was barely up. They're like, okay, when do we get ours? And there have been opportunities to say, well, because Detroit is broke or because Detroit is under state control or because Detroit is counting on federal funds, there was always an excuse. Well, the buck now stops with the city. That means everything they want and they ask the city for, the city can't look to anybody else and say, well, we have to get permission or we have to find the money. They now are in charge of those requests, those demands, those pleas for more attention. And that's happening. You know, the mayor announced during his State of the City that he was going to work on strategic plans to expand what's happening downtown and midtown out to the other neighborhoods. And he's trying to do that. He made an ask just last week of foundations and philanthropic groups to put in money for an expansion to make sure that they create 10 neighborhoods instead of 3. Right now there are 3 that they've been focused on to bring some development and life and commercial excitement to 3 neighborhoods. Well, they want to expand that to 10, and so they're asking folks to put in and do that. And if they do, you know, that will show that we can do some of this out in the neighborhoods. Of course, they still have a little issue with affordable housing because they're using an area index for what is affordable instead of what people in Detroit can afford. And that's going to be a problem because it doesn't matter if you call it affordable housing if people in Detroit can't afford it.
Bottom line, now that the ball is out of the state's court and it is back in the mayor's court and city council's court, what has to happen and what cannot happen at the Coleman A. Young Municipal Building going forward?
Well, what can't happen is for there to continue to be this idea of two Detroits, the Detroit that exists in the downtown and midtown in the 7.2 that's becoming mostly upscale, mostly elite, mostly white, and the people who represent the majority of the population in Detroit feeling left out. I talked to Peter Cummings, the developer, months ago about what could derail the Renaissance, and he said unrest from the folks who feel left out of it. And that is what the city and its leaders have to pay attention to all the time, that people who represent the majority of Detroit don't feel like, and I know this is going to sound very dramatic, but feel like South Africa in the 1980s, where there's this small minority that's doing great, and you've got a whole majority of people who are feeling like second-class citizens. That is the only thing I think right now that could do it, because the city is balanced. The city is spending the money that it has. The city actually is spending less money that it has and is turning in budgets with surpluses. So that's what they have to do, is to focus on that. And if they focus on that and do it in a way that helps the actual people who we're talking about, then Detroit is going to be great.
Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Rochelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How can Michigan attract and retain new talent? It's a question we've heard emanating from Governor Snyder's office and executive suites on down for years now. Earlier this month, a General Motors executive told a room full of automotive engineers that the autonomous vehicle revolution will bypass Detroit unless the region addresses its talent deficit. One of the top places companies look for new talent is at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. According to the school's statistics, just 9% of Ross students stay in Michigan after they get their bachelor's degrees. Now listen to this. That amounts to about 30 students out of 500. With us now are 2 U of M graduates, Maria Fabrizio and Brianna Dispenza. They looked at just how to address this problem when they took a capstone class at Ross called Creativity at Work, taught by our Next Idea partner, Jeff DeGraff. Maria, all semester, you explored why some U of M students stay in Michigan after they graduate and why some don't. What are some of the reasons you found?
Yeah, so I think there were a variety of reasons. We talked to some people in the Ross School of Business, some people in the School of Literature, Science and the Arts and Engineering, and I'm also from Michigan, so I talked to some of my friends that go to Michigan State and also have stayed at Grand Valley as well. And there was a whole variety of reasons why some people would stay and others would not. I think the main reason for not staying is just the lack of big business opportunities in the cities of Grand Rapids and Detroit. While there might be some smaller opportunities, there just didn't seem to be a huge pull for larger, more prestigious sounding companies.
Brianna, what jumped out at you as you explored this question?
One city we looked at was Grand Rapids. And so millennials thinking about what sort of opportunities and activities there are to do in cities, the New York and Chicago usually appear more better than Grand Rapids for sure. So that was just one thing for that age range compared to older people as far as why they enjoy Grand Rapids.
That's a good point. And Maria, you're from Grand Rapids, so tell us about your job situation. I understand you're considering a number of options and most of them kind of revolving around Washington, D.C.
Yeah. So I've kind of, being in so many different communities on campus, had the opportunity to explore a lot of different job opportunities. And one of my potential opportunities could actually end up being in Detroit, which is ironic because I never thought that I would end up there, but that might end up being the case. So we'll see. But yeah, no, I definitely have considered Washington, D.C. I'm a political science and international studies major, so that really is a good spot to be for jobs in that field. But yeah, I've not decided on anything yet, so still waiting.
Just waiting to see. And Brianna, you're from New Orleans.
Yes.
Okay. And after you graduated, I understand you're moving to Benton Harbor and you're going to work at Whirlpool. What were you looking for in that first job?
For my first job, especially after studying abroad in London, I was looking for a place where I can find an adventure sort of every day. And while studying abroad, I realized I'm the type of person to bucket list, and I can take a place that many people might not think is interesting, or they might just do the typical tourist things, but I like to find things that is off the beaten track and is really interesting to do. So when I was looking for a job, I was thinking about New Orleans and possibly going back, but with Whirlpool, I loved their corporation and everything. So, and then when I visited, I was looking at things I could do, like kayaking or what's close by. Chicago's close by and things like that.
And so you've already kind of gotten your mind thinking of things that you're looking forward to exploring in the St. Joe Benton Harbor area.
Yes. The lake was one thing, kayaking, and there's a whole bunch of summer activities to do.
Now, I'm wondering about politics and culture and how the state's culture and political makeup factored in your decision. I'll start with you, Maria.
Yeah, sure. So I think it's a small part of it, but I think really for me, it's more just about the jobs. If there are jobs there, people will stay, I will stay. Like I said, I didn't think I was going to end up in Detroit, but this job that I am really interested in happens to be in Detroit. So that's what's getting me to potentially stay when I never thought that I was going to. So the culture is definitely part of it, but I think anyone that has lived in the state of Michigan, even for a few years, knows that there's a lot to do. And there's Detroit, it has a lot of exciting things going on. Grand Rapids also has a lot of exciting things going on. You just have to be open to it and like look for it a little bit. I think some of my classmates that maybe have not spent as much time in those areas maybe don't know about those things.
How about the politics?
Politics-wise, I'm a Democrat. I can say that. And it's been somewhat of a factor. I've worked on a campaign in the state of Michigan for a Democratic candidate and really enjoyed that. Grand Rapids is more conservative, which doesn't necessarily align with my politics, but has not stopped me from enjoying my time there when I go back for breaks and am with friends.
Brianna, what about you? Your thoughts on Michigan's politics and its culture?
Kind of relating to her, I'm a Democrat as well, but it didn't play a significant role in ending up in Benton Harbor, knowing that my opinions would stay my own, but also feeling like I'd find a community there when I moved there as far as politics and things like that.
How about transportation? How about being able to get around and not have to own a car?
I think that one piece of Michigan that has been challenging is that it was built by the auto industry. So as a consequence, a lot of the parts of the cities are more disparate and you really do need a car to get around, which just makes it less accessible. So even for students on Michigan's campus, the reason that people haven't seen Detroit and don't know about the growth is because they can't access Detroit. And there has been some efforts to increase transportation between the cities, but it's not as widespread as it needs to be.
I would agree. I know that there's a bus that goes from Ann Arbor to Detroit, but this wasn't something I was told about until maybe a year ago. I didn't even know about it. So if this was something even Michigan put in the forefront to students, like, oh, we also have a bus that takes you from Ann Arbor to Detroit so you can explore the rest of Michigan. But yeah.
Yeah, and Grand Rapids is totally cut out of that. So there's absolutely no way to really get to Grand Rapids easily. I know even just when I want to go home for the weekend to see my family, it's really challenging if I don't have access to a car at the time. So there's maybe one bus that will go every, like, I don't know, 8 hours or so, and it's not convenient at all.
So this is really something that is a statewide issue. It's not just Southeast Michigan, although so much of the conversation is about what's happening in Southeast Michigan.
Absolutely.
You know, most of the political and business leaders who are concerned and worried about attracting new talent, shall we say they are not of your generation. do you feel like they're listening to people like you, new graduates, and that they might be on the right track to creating the right climate that could get Michigan to compete with the likes of Chicago and New York?
Yeah, so I actually don't think that it's politicians or big business leaders that are making those cities more attractive to students. I think it's other students. I mean, even just a critical mass of your friends in one city that makes it more attractive to you. So I think if there are enough attractive jobs in a certain area, or if there's enough exciting things happening in Detroit or Grand Rapids, people will want to stay, and then they'll stay because their friends are staying, and it kind of has just a, you know, percolating effect on graduates.
Yes, I would agree. It's definitely word of mouth and friends. If you feel like you have a Michigan community where you're moving to, people are more likely to go to that city or state. So when you're just a sophomore in the business school and you're going to these organization meetings, people are like, well, I went to Chicago or I went to New York, so come along with me. And that's how it happens. It really just depends on word of mouth and recommendation from friends.
What advice would each of you have for our Michigan business leaders who would desperately like to keep folks like you, more young workers, right here in Michigan?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a big question. That's what we spent the whole semester looking at. And I don't think there's a clear answer. If I could answer it in a couple minutes, I probably would have a job now. But I don't. So no, I think there's a lot of things that people can do. I think just continuing to really recruit heavily at universities where they want people. I think continuing to show up for those career fairs and bringing people, a variety of people, to those events. So I know when I go to recruiting events, I find people that have similar backgrounds to me, and I find people that look like me and, yeah, just have similar interests. And that's kind of how you make connections with people, and that's how you find out about jobs and become invested in places, just like what you were saying earlier with your job in Benton Harbor. It's because you like the company, you feel connected to the company. And I think that Michigan companies just need to continue doing that at the recruiting stage, like right away. It's too late after people graduate. At that point, people have already made connections or decided and made their choice. You have to invest in people early on in the college process.
The ship has sailed if you're doing that at this point when you're about to graduate. Brianna, you get the last word.
I would say companies should really try to connect students with the city. So besides just trying to sell them on why the company is a great place to work, why is the city a great place to live? And just from one visit isn't going to sell them. So how can you get them to come back multiple times and really feel a connection to the city that they're going to be living in for more than a year or two? So
help them
really
see themselves there.
Yes.
Help them
exactly.
See themselves.
And
there.
Showing them maybe some unique parts or activities or favorite places to eat, favorite places to do certain activities, get to know the people they're recruiting. And so do they love yoga? Well, here's a yoga place. Or, you know, really convince them that they could see themselves living here on a daily basis.
Yeah, apart from business leaders, what do you think elected leaders, cities can do, communities can do to make themselves more attractive to young workers?
I think just continuing to invest in things that are important to people of our generation. So I think Grand Rapids has done a really good job of expanding. Even their microbreweries has made it so much more fun to go home over winter breaks. The farmers markets are great. There's a lot of opportunities to do things outside. And I think that Michigan cities and cities around the U.S. that really invest in interactive places and activities are the ones that are successful at retaining people.
I would say cities should look into visiting college campuses. So actually bringing those elected officials to college campuses and just talking about the city they're from and what are kids doing during spring break? Could they offer some type of trip or visit for students to come to the city and just spend a day there learning about the city?
Well, advice from the perspective of University of Michigan graduating seniors, Brianna Dispensa and Maria Fabrizio. Thank you so much for being with us and congratulations.
Thank you.
There has been a lot of talk about reviving and restoring Michigan Central, the once proud train station in Detroit's Corktown. But there's another piece of Detroit history that needs some of that love and attention, the Detroit House, where the man who won the Civil War for the Union and then went on to become president once lived. Ulysses S. Grant lived in Detroit when he was a young Army lieutenant. And after years of neglect, there is an effort afoot to save Grant's home. Dan Austin of HistoricDetroit.org is here with us. Dan, when did Grant live in Detroit?
So he lived in Detroit before the Civil War when he was fresh out of West Point. So he moved to Detroit in 1849, and he lived in this house in question from April of 1849 to May of 1850. So it's a pretty short window, but we'll take it and call him an honorary Detroiter nonetheless.
Indeed. So long before he was a general leading the Army of the Union and what they then called in the North the War of the Rebellion. So he was a young guy then.
Yep, he was a young guy, like I said, fresh out of West Point. There used to be military barracks over near where Lafayette Park is today. And so this house, which is now at the State Fairgrounds, actually was much closer to downtown. It was on East 4th Street between Russell and Rivard.
Tell us a little about the house.
So it's not, it doesn't look like much from the outside. You know, sometimes it's the history of a place, not its beauty. It's just a two-story clapboard house. You know, but it's who lived there, the history that happened within its walls that make it so significant. But at the same time, it's worth noting that this is one of the oldest surviving structures in the city of Detroit. There are only a handful of them that date to the 1830s, 1840s.
So historically significant in a couple of different ways. You know, I grew up in Ferndale, so I could walk to the State Fair and did it every year. And I remember very well that historic White House. So how did it wind up at the Michigan State Fairgrounds?
So back in the 1930s, Detroit was ready to demolish it. They were clear-cutting that area as part of an urban renewal project. And the Michigan Mutual Liability Company stepped forward, bought the house, and paid to move it to the State Fairgrounds in 1936. So that was when it was saved initially. And then it was moved again about 20 years later within the fairgrounds to its present site, and it sat there ever since.
And I think I remember, I'm reaching back a few years, we used to be able to go through it when we would go to the fairgrounds.
Yes, and it was a big tourist attraction or fair grower attraction, I mm-hmm. suppose. So they would have a lot of period reenactment stuff there, history stuff. And it sounds like that's kind of what they want to have the house be again over near the DeQuinter Cut. You know, they're talking about a community space with some historical programming.
So how has the house fared? I'm kind of flinching as I ask you how it's fared since the State Fair ended and the fairgrounds closed in 2010. What condition is it in now?
I've seen worse. You know, the house hadn't really been used in quite some time. It was a storage facility toward the end of the fairgrounds' life. I'm not even sure exactly when it stopped being open to the public. So it's a little bit run down, totally salvageable. But the one question here is that when they moved the house from Lafayette Park area to the fairgrounds in 1936, we didn't have as many power lines and freeway overpasses and things like that. So it was much easier to move it. The question becomes, once you cut this thing apart, you cut it in two, what needs to happen to ensure that a house that's a little bit run down might be suffering some rot, it is a wooden house, you know, what kind of shape it's in? I think at that point we'll know a lot more about the condition of this house.
And the clock is ticking, isn't it, Dan Austin, because the old fairgrounds has been sold to the city of Detroit and to Magic Johnson's development company. So it's move it or lose it, right?
Well, yes, the city of Detroit did buy 142 acres of the fairgrounds, and Magic Johnson's got another 16 of them. But I can't imagine that either of those parties are going to say, if you don't get it off this property within X time, we're tearing it down. I don't see that being an issue. That said, the logistics of moving a house that was built in 1837 clear across town, there are a lot of logistics involved. It's going to be expensive. So it's good to start planning that stuff now and trying to get the stuff taken care of so we're not running around, you know, redeveloping that site around this house with plans to eventually move it.
So you mentioned Eastern Market near the DeQuinter Cut. So who's behind efforts to get this house revived and moved?
That would be the state DNR. So the state is planning on setting it up there at the DeQuinter Cut near Eastern Market. They will be in charge of the programming. We talked a couple years ago, you and I, mm-hmm. when the DNR was planning on trying to move it over to the DEPSA, the Detroit Edison Public School Academy property, which is also over there near the De Quinter Cut at St. Aubin and Gratiot. That was 3 years ago now, and that plan fell apart. But I think that the overall goal of having the DNR do to this house, kind of what they did with the old Detroit dry dock, the Globe Trading Building over there along the river, and making it some kind of a public space once again, that seems like the strategy.
When you think, you refer to how expensive it would be to basically dissect this old house and then do this big move across town, expensive. So is money there? Are they looking for private partners to help underwrite this?
I imagine that any and all help will be most welcome. I don't have any clue what it's going to cost to move this thing. It will not be cheap, that's for sure. So I think that last I had heard, and talking with folks involved with the project, they don't necessarily have the funding and the approvals final. So if any listeners out there want to save a house where a future U.S. president and Civil War hero once lived in Detroit, one of the oldest houses in Detroit, I'm sure the state would be happy to talk to you and take your check.
Dan Austin, historicdetroit.org. It's always great talking history with you, Dan. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A young, pregnant environmental activist is now serving a 2-year sentence in a Michigan prison. But Suwatu Sulama Ra says she acted in self-defense when she pulled a gun last summer on a neighbor. Michigan Radio Sarah Swick tells us her story and what it could tell us about cases where black gun owners claim self-defense.
Suwatu Sulama Ra was born into what her mother, Rhonda Anderson, calls Detroit's African-centered activist culture community.
Suwatu's name means born during war to bring in peace sent by God.
Anderson is a prominent activist in that community, and as she grew up, Ra became one too. She became passionate about environmental justice, fighting for people burdened by the toxic contaminants and other environmental burdens that haunt poor industrial cities like Detroit. As Ra blossomed into a young activist in her own right, Anderson says her work took her far beyond the city.
She's been to Turkey. She's been to Paris. She's been to Senegal.
But Anderson is a strong believer that the many stresses of life in Detroit create other kinds of toxic situations. And one arose last July in front of her home on the city's west side.
This incident really was a result of an altercation that two children had had.
That's Victoria Burton Harris. She's Ra's attorney. The two children are Ra's teenage niece and the daughter of a neighbor. They were friends, but they had a fight at school. The two girls made up, but tensions lingered between their families. That's important because of what happened next. On July 16th, the neighbor girl showed up at Anderson's house. Ra was there. She told the girl to leave. Burton Harris says the girl called her mother, crying, to come back and pick her up.
And she was irate when she pulled up.
From there, the stories diverge. Here's the neighbor's story. Ra approached her car, angry, and told her to leave. She says Ra got a gun and pointed it at her and her daughter. The neighbor says she accidentally hit Ra's car as she tried to pull away, but she stopped to snap cell phone pictures of Ra holding her gun. That's one version of events. Ra tells a different story. She says the neighbor returned in a rage and started using her car as a weapon. She rammed Ra's parked car with Ra's 2-year-old daughter inside. Her mom, Rhonda Anderson, came into the street to intervene. This is Ra speaking in a video supporters recently made about her case.
So she's literally going back and forth with this car, putting in reverse and fixing herself to come at us again. My mother, who was also standing very close to me, wasn't able to run.
Ra says that's when she pulled her gun out. It was unloaded and licensed. She pointed it at the neighbor and her daughter in their car.
I was afraid. And I told her, you have to leave now.
That question of fear, of what fear looks like, when it's justified, and who decides that, is at the heart of this case. It's also at the heart of Michigan self-defense law. Stephen Doolin is with the Michigan Coalition of Responsible Gun Owners and an adjunct professor at Cooley Law School. Doolin says pulling a gun is always considered deadly force. The person using deadly force has no duty to retreat from a threatening situation. But
deadly force is appropriate self-defense only when preventing death, great bodily harm, or rape, imminent death, great bodily harm, or rape.
It's a two-pronged legal test. There must be an actual imminent threat, and your use of deadly force must be reasonable.
So you have to actually believe it, and basically the jury has to agree that your fear was reasonable under the circumstances.
Ra didn't have to take her case to a jury. Her first lawyer encouraged her to take a plea deal. But Ra didn't want that. Again, her trial attorney, Victoria Burton Harris.
Suatu rejected that advice and said, I would rather fight this. I am not who they are painting me as. I acted in self-defense. I'd like to present my case to a jury.
All the jury had to go on were these dueling stories and the three cell phone pictures the neighbor took of Ra pointing her gun. Burton Harris, as the prosecutor, made a big deal out of those pictures. He said Ra didn't look scared in them. Burton Harris questions that perception.
Fear looks different on some people versus others. And that was a part of what the jury had to analyze and determine.
The jury apparently agreed with the prosecution. It found Ra guilty of felonious assault against the neighbor. Jurors also found Ra guilty on an added felony firearms charge, and that's a mandatory 2-year sentence under Michigan law. Ra thinks the jury saw her as angry rather than scared. And she thinks that's at least partly because of her race.
The way the world views what black fear looks like, if I was somebody else, maybe, just maybe, they would have identified with when I said I was afraid.
Steve Doolin of Cooley Law School says it's hard to know for sure whether black defendants who invoke self-defense are convicted more often than white defendants in similar cases.
I honestly don't think we have enough data on that. I think it's a legitimate concern. And I think more data needs to be gathered.
But Ra's mom, Rhonda Anderson, is also convinced that stereotypes, particularly ideas of black women as innately angry, helped convict her daughter.
I know she was innocent, that she was doing exactly as she said. She was protecting me, herself, and her daughter from a person that was enraged.
Ra now sits in prison, 7 months pregnant. She had serious complications with her first pregnancy, and her current one is considered high risk. Ra's legal team plans to appeal her conviction, but first they're trying to secure an appeals bond. That would allow Ra to go free while the case is on appeal and not have to deliver her baby behind bars. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
Let's talk more about being black and a gun owner. With us are Tanisha Moner, a gun owner with multiple certifications, including Chief Range Safety Officer and an NRA certified instructor. And Chad Kings, co-founder of the Black Bottom Gun Club. This is the Detroit chapter of the National African American Gun Association. Tanisha, why did you first decide to buy a gun?
Well, it was a long process. I had friends who were concerned about my well-being because I did move around a lot solo, you know, by myself. And so I had friends who were trying to convince me, you know, you shouldn't be out unarmed. You should be able to fight fire with fire. And I really had no interest, and I was scared of guns. So one day I finally decided I would, like, defeat that, you know, beat my fear. And I went and took a CPL class, and that's where it all started.
And, Chad, you grew up in an anti-gun household, right?
Absolutely. I grew up in a single-parent home, single mother. And my mother was vehemently against firearms, water guns, Nerf guns, making guns with rubber bands, you name it. She was totally against it at the time. But I think that was more so of a product or a result of where I grew up at. And the neighborhood that I grew up at was susceptible to gun violence.
Tell us how you grew up to become a strong advocate for gun ownership.
There was, a confluence of a couple of different things. One of the things that I learned, you know, fairly early on is that there have always been two rights that have been the litmus test for black Americans being fully fledged and fully enfranchised citizens of the United States. First and foremost, voting, and secondly, exercising the Second Amendment. And I look at that from a historical lens to a degree. There have always been efforts to curtail people's, particularly black Americans, ability to vote, and there have always been efforts to curtail black Americans' ability to own firearms for self-defense and protecting their families. So that was part of it. The other part of it was an unfortunate incident on my wedding anniversary in 2007. My wife and I came home early from celebrating, We came in and saw our home. We lived in a townhouse, and everything was busted open. The door was kicked open off the frame and hinges. We saw everything strewn about. Some things were missing. Department maintenance folks weren't able to get anyone to fix the door until very early the next morning. So I took my wife that night. I went and bought a shotgun to make sure that we would be safe.
And now here you are as the co-founder of the Detroit chapter of the National African American Gun Association. Tanisha, as we heard in Sarah's story, it was very clear. Suwatu Sulama Ra said she was treated differently by the justice system as a Black woman. And she said, I was so afraid, especially for my toddler and mother. I don't believe they could imagine a Black woman being scared, only mad. Does that quote resonate with you?
Absolutely. Too frequently, Black women are viewed as having, you know, a chip on our shoulder, or we have an attitude problem, or we have all these other negative things that are just ingrained inherently in Black people, in the minds of some people. However, we are absolutely fearful just like anyone else. We worry about our lives just like anyone else. Even before this situation here, we see it all the time. Black women aren't viewed as possible victims in the way that other people are. And I really think it's sad. It's not fair.
And so you feel you're treated differently as a Black woman carrying a gun?
My experience overall has been fairly positive for the most part. I do know people who haven't been as fortunate as myself, though.
In fact, Chad, do you have other stories that come to mind of coming into contact with authorities as a legal gun owner?
As for myself personally, I haven't had that experience, and I hope to keep it that way, which is a big reason why I'm a proponent of concealed carry. But as far as stories go from other people, you know, when you look through history, as Black people carrying firearms, one of the immediate stories come to mind is the story of Ossian Sweet, who purchased a home on Garland Avenue. It was in a predominantly white neighborhood in the city of Detroit. His family was accosted and harassed, and they threw rocks at his home and bricks through his window and tried to set a firebomb off in his house through the window, and him and his family were able to defend themselves. When you look at firearms laws and interaction with police, one of the things that we have to consider, Black people are not dissimilar from any other group or demographic. We have the same types of fears. We have the same type of needs and wants to be safe and secure in our person and to make sure our families are secure as well. Unfortunately, considering the slant that we find in this country, in particular, the anti-Black slant that we find, in addition to the different stereotypes of Black people with guns, those are all that we have to combat. And I look forward to that type of a challenge.
And we should note, certainly talking about history, Dr. Ossian Sweet was charged with murder in 1925.
Absolutely.
After he and friends were using armed self-defense against that crowd of hostile white people protesting his moving into, air quotes here, their neighborhood. So here we have history important in looking at the history of suppressing African-American rights in your own personal genealogical history. So what have you learned from being a student of history, and how has that informed your philosophy on gun ossership, Tanisha?
Since we mentioned Ossian Sweet, I was very fortunate in the sense that my family grew up in close affiliation with the family who actually purchased the Sweet home down on Garland, and the family who saw to it that that place was preserved and recognized as a National Historic Site. So I always knew the history of that. My growing up was quite a bit different than my counterpart here. My father was absolutely pro-gun. My dad never had hang-ups about guns being in the house. My dad felt like there should be a gun in every room of his home because he believed in protecting his family.
Chad, how do you prepare or educate members of the Black Bottom Gun Club, both on responsible gun ownership and the disparate treatment that a Black gun owner may face when dealing with the police or, in Ra's case, a court of law?
There's a couple of things that we do. I don't want to say that you can overemphasize safety, because I don't think it's possible to overemphasize being safe with a firearm. You have to have a different mindset when you possess a firearm and when you're in possession or control of a firearm than not, because it is a tool like any other tool, but it has the capacity to do things and alter life permanently for yourself or other people. So first and foremost, we put a huge emphasis on operating safely, being able to de-escalate situations, if at all possible, things like that to deal with the mindset of what it takes to be a responsible gun owner. That's one piece of it. The other piece of it is the history and getting a clear understanding of what it means to be a black gun owner. We spoke about Dr. Ossian Sweet. You know, in our meetings, we also go over people like Robert F. Williams, who wrote Negroes with Guns, and giving, you know, our members the understanding that generally we carry firearms as a mechanism historically to defend against racialized violence. Unfortunately, today we look at Dylann Roof, right? So the racialized violence is still present in American society, and as black gun owners, we need to be prepared to defend ourselves and defend our families from that racialized violence. Now, getting with the legal component of it, what we do in our chapter, we have legal seminars roughly about every quarter, a few times a year, where we have a firearms legal expert come in and discuss different scenarios or give us an overview of Michigan law and surrounding state law. Scenarios such as what happens after a self-defense shooting, the cost involved with it, how you need to prepare yourself financially, and in the aftermath of it as well.
Tanisha, I know you are an NRA certified instructor. I got to ask you, the NRA has been criticized for using some race baiting tactics to build support. Have you got any issues with those tactics of the NRA?
For full disclosure, not only am I an NRA certified instructor, I'm also a member of the NRA. I don't think any organization in any area is absolutely 100% together. I think there's room for growth and opportunity. I understand, you know, that there are issues and challenges. However, my personal experience with the NRA has been mostly positive. I haven't had any instances where I felt like I was being discriminated against. There are fringe people in every group. If you go to even some black groups, it's like, okay, you're way over here. You know, I just think we all need to learn some effective communication. I think the NRA has some very positive stand. I think some of the things they say are absolutely on point. Are there things I don't agree with? Absolutely. But that doesn't make the organization as a whole be something that should be demonized. I don't believe that.
Just final few moments, a thought from you, if I could, Chad. When you think that we hear descriptions of gun violence in this country described as an epidemic, how do you see a way forward that balances your Second Amendment rights with the need to keep communities safe from gun violence?
So the data shows, at least the FBI data shows, that violent crime has actually gone down over the past 30 years. I don't see an epidemic in that, right? You hear a lot of times about AR-15s. People want to ban AR-15s, right? Roughly since about 2014 or, you know, between 2012 and 2016, less than 500 deaths total have been a result of an AR-15. You have many more times, that three or four times that amount of deaths as a result of knife violence or hand-to-hand type of a fighting, right? So what we have to do is look at two things, history, and we have to look at data. Unless we're looking at those two things, then we won't be able to craft an accurate response, and we'll be operating based on emotion. You know, firearms, they've been in our country since forever. It's a founding precept of the establishment of the United States of America. You can get involved by, number one, understanding how they operate, and number two, making sure that you're safe while operating, whether you're, you know, exercise your Second Amendment rights or not, to understand that these things are not the boogeyman. We have to deal with people on a person-to-person basis. We have to communicate more with one another. There are some countries that have a high rate of firearm ownership, but lower rate of crime. On a societal level, we have to create a culture of support that seeks to deter violence, right? Whether you're talking about economically, educationally, socially, politically, et cetera, we have to create that culture of support to deal with those things and not deal with the mechanism or tool people use.
I want to thank very much Tanisha Mohner and Chad King. Chad is co-founder of the Black Bottom Gun Club, Tanisha, gun owner, multiple certifications. We want to thank you so much for sharing your views with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a quick note, numbers from the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program do show that in 2016, there were more deaths by knives than by rifles, including AR-15s. That said, reporting to the FBI is voluntary. And as deaths are not broken down by rifle type in the data, there is no way to know exactly how many deaths occurred from AR-15s. And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.